Hello, friends, and welcome back to the second hour of Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW here in Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle on 1150 AM in the United States. The program focuses on Out of This World information, and today's program is truly Out of This World. With Courtney Brown of the Farsight Institute in Georgia, we've been discussing Mars, Atlantis, a little bit about 9/11, and using Courtney's wonderful techniques to remote view all these different planets and situations, things that have happened, to gain enlightenment. And the intro song for my program is of course by The Who, I Can See for Miles and Miles, and I play that song because I want to raise consciousness and make this planet a much better and happier place. Courtney, let's continue our discussion. You were talking earlier about Atlantis.
Yeah, there are a couple really glaring underwater anomalies on the bottom of the ocean, and one is, and it's very clearly visible in Google Earth images, and one is 1,000 miles west of Portugal and Morocco, mm-hmm. and 3 miles deep. And it looks like the ruins of an ancient city. And Google Earth had sort of a 1.0 version and a 2.0 version. Mm-hmm. And a 2.0 version really tried to smear them out. But the 1.0 version was very, very clear. And I give a good description of how the degradation of the images was not a result of better image processing, but in my opinion, extreme image compression that was utilized to smear them. And that, you know, I explained that in the video, and it's also on our website at Farsight, www.farsight.org. And you also see the images themselves, and you can decide for yourself what you think is going on based on what I clearly point out. What is the evidence of extreme image compression that mm-hmm. wipes out detail and so on. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was these ruins on the bottom of the ocean. We had, I was curious about what actually caused it. So I assigned those to our remote viewers who are the best remote viewers on the planet, mm-hmm. Using military or military-derived methodologies. Mm-hmm. And they did it under totally blind conditions. Mm-hmm. And we got the whole backstory. And it was a surprise to me. So basically, that happened about 70,000 years ago. We had the timing pretty good. Uh-huh. So about 70,000 years ago, we had an advanced human that was us, our ancestors, high-tech civilization that was about 100 years more advanced than us today. Mm-hmm. And some of your listeners, some of the skeptical ones perhaps, might be rolling their eyes and say, oh my God, 70,000 years ago, we were hunter-gatherers at best. You know, no. We still looked like half-chimps back then and so on. Well, the reality is that's not true. There's the evidence on the bottom of the ocean is very clear, and we have governments that are spending a huge amount of money in Antarctica doing digs. Now, they're not looking for mastodon bones. They're looking for technology that's buried under the ice, and a lot of that is actually visible in Google Earth images and pictures that you can see, but it's not taught at the mainstream. And there's a lot of archaeological evidence that has been that is not taught at the universities, that's just simply omitted. It's simply like a whole fairy tale is told about how civilization is only 3,000 years old. Well, anyway, this information is allowed, these so-called exceptions that are just written out of mainstream thought, once those are allowed into being allowed to be thought,
right,
then the whole house of cards falls, and you realize we did have a technologically advanced civilization. And what basically happened, we had the whole backstory. First, the remote viewers recreated exactly what we saw on the Google Earth images, both down in Antarctica and 1,000 miles west of Portugal and Morocco.
Okay.
And that they were underwater, and there was an event that happened. And basically what happened, we had a society that was very much like us today, secrecy-based, and there was a military-industrial operation that was going on, controlled in Antarctica, but the drilling was actually out in the New Zealand area. And New Zealand, what they basically did, this is a balloon. Our planet is a balloon of 8,000-mile diameter ball of liquid molten rock, mm-hmm. with an 8-mile thin crust. So it's a balloon. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they thought they could control it. They were going after the heat in the inside. And they actually drilled huge boreholes straight through the crust to see if they could get at the heat. And they thought they could control it. And then it became obvious that it was getting out of control and they weren't going to be able to. And what they did is they popped the balloon. They blew out a huge hole in the Earth. And that area out near New Zealand has got the thinnest crust on the planet. And it's also got the largest concentration of lava rock.
Hmm.
Well, the antipode of that spot is the exact opposite spot on the globe. And where is that? It's exactly right dead center in that anomaly on the bottom of the ocean of the Atlantic Ocean, 1,000 miles west of Portugal and Morocco, 3 miles deep. So basically what used to happen, because if you blow out one side of the planet, you're going to get a dent in the other.
Right.
And so what happened was Europe actually used to extend about 1,000 miles west of where it is now.
Fascinating.
And it sunk. It just went down because there was a huge blowout on the opposite side of the globe.
Wow.
And so similarly, you had massive tidal waves and massive all types of other problems. And civilization was crashed down to bare bones again. But that one was not caused by the sun burping or, coronal mass ejection. That was caused by us. We popped the balloon.
Right.
And so the video for that is available now. And it's currently available as a DVD on Amazon and as a video on demand in Vimeo. Although that video is going to be made available for free on YouTube in May. So next month it will be available for free on YouTube.
May I share something with you, Courtney, that just came through?
Yeah.
The messages I'm getting from my higher guides is that, and this is confirmed by Professor Einstein and Professor Trilling, that you and I both had lived during Atlantis during its last phases about 12,500 years ago, and we had been trying to stop the kind of destruction that occurred back then. We failed, basically, and so we've reincarnated during this time to raise consciousness, to steer humanity away from a self-destructive path that occurred about 13,000 years ago. So this is
well, that's not surprising, that because people tend to hang around where they are,
right?
It's also not surprising that when we remote viewed Mars with the Cydonia region, the face on Mars,
right.
Those people looked like us. The remote viewers nowhere describe people that looked alien, that looked weird. Mm-hmm. And also, when you remote view humans, I don't, you know, it's hard to make generalizations, but generally speaking, if you find someone who says, "I don't know how to stop these remote viewers from stalking me. How do I get my privacy back?" The best advice for those people is they need to see a doctor and get back on their meds, because it's just not happening. First of all, remote viewers can't use their thing to spy on individuals like that because it has to be done under totally blind conditions. The amount of effort that's used for a single remote viewing is humongous. Mm-hmm. The amount of training to get someone good enough to be able to do it at all means that if you ever give them a ridiculous target like your neighbor, they will never work with you again. I mean, it's like it's got to be a big thing or you're fired.
Right.
And so it can't even be done with that. So the idea of sort of, if someone's saying, "But I feel them, I know they're spying on me," that person's sick. The person needs to see a doctor. But so the reality is, when we remote viewed the Martians, when the remote viewers went to the Martians, we don't have a single case of one of those Martians turning around and looking at the remote viewer and saying, "Ah, I'm seeing a remote viewing." Now, that's not the case with extraterrestrials. Some extraterrestrials actually can do that. They can actually, and they turn right around, and the remote viewers report it. They turn right around and look at the person, like you're leaving a presence when you're remote viewing, and the extraterrestrials turn right around and look at you. And sometimes we've had situations where they start up conversations. But the point is that with the Martians, there was nothing like that. They were just like us. Now, Mars, for reasons that we can get into, which would be very nice, died. Yeah, there is some life there now, but you're talking, you're not talking a civilization. You're talking about some outposts buried underneath doing some stuff and hanging about and doing, you're not talking about
a major civilization anymore.
Yeah, you're not talking major civilization. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of people living there on the planet, walking on the surface, breathing air, things like that, that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is that they were us. They were like us. So what I like to think of it is, when they did in their own world, when that happened, there are actually two major events. And when that happened, where do they go? I mean, eternity is a long time to hang around. Where do you go?
Right.
Well, do you leap over to another star system, or basically do you just look around at your neighborhood and say, oh, there's another place I can go?
Yeah.
And so I like to think of the Martians not as aliens over there, but as us when we were there.
I agree with
Not Martians over there, but us when we were there.
Sure, I agree with
and
you.
And now we're over here.
Right.
And so a lot of the same patterns that you're talking about,
right,
it makes perfect sense that we could experience the same things. We're the same people.
Right.
And it's natural. I'm not like drawing on remote viewing evidence. I'm just saying common sense. If you're not living there anymore, where are you going to go? Well, you're going to go to the nearest place, you know. You know, if your house burns down, what are you going to do? Move to Russia?
Mm-hmm.
If your house burns down, you're going to build another house in the next city.
Sure.
Or in the same city, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe on the same road.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not going to, you know, you're not going to leave planets just because your house burns down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, anyway. But basically what we found with the Cydonia stuff, again, it was done under totally blind conditions. And you can see it all yourself, the original remote viewing. And it's fascinating to watch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can access the videos just by going to farsight.org.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn a lot about how psychic perception works when you see this stuff come in, knowing it's done under totally blind conditions, and you see that the results are coming in spot on accurate with regard to all the verifiable elements.
Mm-hmm.
And so then what we have is we have the whole backstory. So right now it's on the so-called face on Mars. We have no evidence that it was a face. It was a city. And it looks like it was surrounded by water.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a city that had a small city, but, you know, it's 3 kilometers from corner to corner.
Mm-hmm.
And it had buildings and things in it that are just like us now. It had poor areas.
Mm-hmm.
It had rich areas. Underneath, it had middle areas. And underneath, it had tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
We've got really good high-resolution images of some of the tunnels on Mars that have been exposed through erosion. Well, these remote viewers described a lot of stuff under the ground. And if, in fact, Cydonia was a major population center, that wouldn't totally make sense. That
mm-hmm.
would make a lot of sense that the tunnels would be there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we have the remote viewers describing these things, the underground facilities underneath Cydonia. That's new information, but it becomes so believable because the above ground information that we know from the pictures, really high resolution pictures, was so accurate when they described it. And you see it live on video. And there's a tension because you as an audience knows what the target is, what they're supposed to be describing. But it's clear that they don't know. But the things that they're saying is so exactly dead on. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really very exciting to watch it happen live like that. Anyway, so what we had is they had charismatic leaders. They had people that were just like us,
wow.
religious type leaders. A lot of poor people that followed those people, the masses followed those leaders. And then you had a level of technology. We don't have images of like jet aircraft. Now they could have had these things, but we don't have images of things like flying about. What we have is seems to suggest that either their major form of transportation or one of their major forms of transportation was rail-type traffic in these tunnels underneath Mars.
Interesting.
So the idea... Now, you have to think about it. It sort of makes sense. It is a smaller planet, had a lot of water,
mm-hmm.
and that's not in dispute. And the gravity is lighter and the air was thinner. So the idea of flying airplanes and jets...
Sure.
...doesn't make as much sense there mm-hmm. as it does here, because our atmosphere, our gravity is heavier and our atmosphere is a lot thicker. So like when you're driving down the highway 70 miles an hour, whatever, and you stick your hand out the window, mm-hmm. you can really feel that hand is being pushed back.
Sure.
I mean, it's a lot of pressure.
Sure.
So flying through soup like that makes mm-hmm. sense. I mean, the airfoils will really produce a huge amount of lift. The atmosphere is really thick. But if you have a much thinner atmosphere, there's going to be less of an incentive. It's not saying that you couldn't do it,
mm-hmm.
but that there's not as much to hold up a heavy object.
Right.
And so tunnels with rail traffic make a lot more sense. Now, it would still be breathable, but yeah, I mean, it's not so thin that you can't breathe. It would be like living sort of in Denver, I guess, or in the Andes or something. You know, it's thinner air, but it's okay.
Courtney, sorry to interrupt, my friend, but I have a whole bunch of questions. I just want to interject just two quick ones. My friends in the Galactic Alliance tell me that outside of this planet, that money per se is a reptilian concept, and it's not used on advanced human civilizations outside of planet Earth. Did they have money, or what? Or were people's needs just taken care of, and it really wasn't a factor?
You know, we didn't see any monetary exchange, but since they were poor people and rich people, money would have made a lot of sense to them. I mean, sure. I can't imagine them not having some type of
medium.
You know,
of
also,
exchange.
And also, we are going to recreate things the way we remember them. So we use money here. So you can just assume, in my opinion, that they had money there.
Okay, all right.
Money becomes a less relevant concept when you have a more advanced civilization, but
true.
You don't have to go reptilian or anything like that. It's just that when you have a developing civilization, and we are always in a state of development because eventually our civilizations on this planet get ground down to pulp again because of some event that occurs, because of the nature of the planet being so volatile, especially of a giant 8,000-mile diameter ball of liquid rock.
Right.
So whenever something happens and the civilization crumbles again because of natural, let alone artificial causes, it's going to build up again. So you'll get a repeated exchange, a reappearance of money. We never actually get to the point where we're so wealthy as a civilization that money can be dispensed with.
Sure.
So you could probably find money in use in a lot of our civilizations going way back. But the point is that that in Mars, it really looked like Cincinnati. They had buildings, they had everything, and they had a perimeter, like a perimeter wall around it. And when you look at the photos of the so-called face of Mars, the high resolution stuff, the whole idea of it being a face, I actually watched that whole thing when it actually happened.
Uh-huh.
And I thought it was so humorous because I said, who would build a face that's 3 kilometers from corner to corner?
Sure.
That faces up. I mean, what you're going to do is you're going to do things that will maximize your short-term interests with your followers, be it political followers, you know, leaders and things like that. But you're not going to build something that points up that big, that's huge. So it doesn't make sense that it would be a face, but it does make sense that it's artificial. And so when the higher resolution photos came in, when NASA sent back probes after the original Viking images seemed to suggest a face, and then they sent other probes that had higher resolution, and they said, see, it's not a face.
Sure.
Well,
sure.
The mainstream media ignored the whole face stuff, but they were very quick to jump in and broadcast NASA's triumphant statement, see, it's not a face. But by doing that, it was like a magician. You know, Ted, how a magician works. Mm. A magician will do something with the right hand to distract you while the left hand is doing something else.
Right.
So while they're focusing on, hey, see, it's not a face, and then quickly dismissing the whole thing, what they're doing is distracting you from looking at the obvious. There's a perimeter around the whole thing. I mean, and it's got exactly perfect, exactly parallel sides, a perfect corner, and an exactly perpendicular side, and a perfect semicircle on the other end. I mean, it's absolutely unmistakable. And nobody was noticing it because everyone was saying, see, it's not a face.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
It was ridiculous.
Sure.
But
sure.
The point is, that's what I was looking at. And so I said, I really want to target that area, not because of the face issue. I thought the face issue was just stupid.
Sure.
But the perimeter is as clear as day. I mean, there's a wall around the whole thing.
Sure.
So I said, who made the wall?
Sure.
And so we got the whole backstory on that. By the way, we know that there were two events in Mars, if you want to get into it. One was an event that was cataclysmic for the whole planet. And the other one was also an event, but it was a nuclear event. That was what finished them off. If you want me to go into that, I can.
A little bit, but I have to ask you these important questions, and they're serious questions, actually. What about entertainment? Did they have movie houses there? Did you see any restaurants? Did you see fast food restaurants? And did McDonald's exist on Mars when you saw it?
I don't know if any particular chains existed, but you can assume that everything existed the way we see it now. It looked like a city, just like it had all the types of infrastructure, buildings, lights. And it's all very clearly portrayed in the video and in spot on detail. I mean, you're not talking about ambiguous drawings. And the drawings so closely match. Now, we had the remote viewers go back in time to when that area was in its... We had them go two time periods. Right now, what it looks like right now, and they were spot on accurate. Mm-hmm. Then we had to go back 10,000... I mean, to whenever it was in its prime condition. And there you saw a lot of people gathering. They had this idea of gathering and listening to leaders that had sort of a charismatic hold on people. It was very much like us.
Interesting.
It was crazy like us. Mm-hmm. It was us when we were there.
Fascinating. Well, and you were going to mention something about the time frame? You were going to details about what
it
happened?
There were two things that happened. You see... we always match, remote viewing is always done where you take physical evidence and that is unambiguous, that you clearly see, and then you send remote viewers there under blind conditions and fill in the details, but they have to recreate that. So from our other studies, another study that we've done at the Institute dealing with the origin of the asteroid belt, we know that the asteroid belt was created from a planet that exploded. Now, that was the original idea for the creation of the asteroid belt when the asteroids were first discovered. But mainstream science has long sort of pushed that out and said, no, it's the solar nebula hypothesis, which is the dominant, which is it was junk that is left over from when the primordial solar nebula was formed and the planets were first condensing. Mm-hmm. But that's really stupid. There's absolutely not a shred of evidence to support that. And there's a ton of evidence that supports the opposite, an exploding planet. The exploding planetary data were collected in a really great detail by Thomas van Flandern, who was a very mainstream astronomer, now dead, but he was the head of his Department of Celestial Mechanics at the Naval Observatory, and he's extensively well-published in mainstream circles. And he collected an enormous amount of data indicating that there was a planet there that exploded. He didn't explain why it exploded, but he did explain. But I can clearly summarize some of the biggies.
Okay.
The asteroids are big, like Ceres asteroids and stuff like that. I mean, they're big. They're rocks. Mm-hmm. You don't get big rocks that are hard like that from a primordial solar nebula. Dust doesn't form into big rocks like that. You need a gravity well to compress the stuff to make a hard rock. Mm-hmm. So that's number one. And some of the rocks are huge, like Ceres and things like that. So the second thing is that the asteroids give evidence on their surface of being exposed to extreme heat that melted rock. Mm-hmm. So that in combination with the fact that the rocks exist in the first place indicates that it's weird. Also, we have good solid evidence that the explosion happened that threw a lot of rocks out of the solar system, and those are comets. Mm-hmm. A lot of comets have extreme elliptical orbits, and we can date the explosion because the comets are coming back. Some of these comets are coming back in for the first time, and that means that they were shot out. Mm-hmm. So we have to know the period of their orbit to know when the thing actually happened. So there was a planet, and it did explode, and that, in fact, we did a huge study on with remote viewing. It completely corroborated Thomas van Flandern's data, and nothing supported the solar nebula's hypothesis data. And in addition, that was with the origin of the big black splotch on the side of Iapetus, which is a moon of Saturn, came about. That was part of the debris wave from the explosion. Well, the reason I brought this up when we're talking about Mars is because one half of Mars, literally one half, is absolutely pelted with huge craters.
Well,
the other side of Mars is crater free.
Fascinating.
In addition, the cratered side of Mars is about a kilometer more thick. The surface, the crust, is a kilometer more thick than the uncratered side. So something happened, something exploded near Mars. Now, the possibility exists, I don't know for sure, but it's possible that Mars may have been a moon of this planet that exploded. And so when this planet exploded, that was a bad day for Mars. But apparently it did not kill off Mars, the life on Mars, it did kill off Cydonia, meaning what happened with Cydonia, and this is very clear in the remote viewing data, and you can see it live on video. You really have to see it to believe it, is it was inundated. It was water. It were tidal waves all over the place. It swamped the tunnels. It swamped everything. Mm. Water, water, water.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
what happened. And so when the planet exploded, mm-hmm. that was what brought it to an end. But that didn't kill off life
mm-hmm.
completely on Mars. Mars continued. And why do we know that? Because much later on Mars, there was a nuclear fission, nuclear detonation on the surface of Mars. And we know that because of the, not of remote viewing, but because of the radioactive isotope readings, basically xenon, in the atmosphere. It's very clear, and on the surface of the rocks, it's very clear that it exactly matches. It's a unique nuclear forensic element,
mm-hmm.
and it exactly matches a fission, a fusion, but a fission nuclear detonation on the surface of Mars, and they actually know where it happened and so on. And this is not actually in dispute among people who know what they're talking about and authorities, but we do know that that is what blew off the rest of the atmosphere.
About how long ago, Courtney, approximately? Did you have is there a time frame for that?
Actually, I do have time frames for that, but
okay.
I don't remember them. I normally
That's
keep
right.
them on me. I normally keep
That's
them.
Okay.
If we were just going to be talking about the ancient stuff, but
yeah.
the original stuff... looks like the planetary explosion happened, looks like around 10 million years ago, which is not long ago.
Sure.
And approximately the nuclear explosion on Mars happened upwards of 100,000 years ago. So we don't know where that is. It could be a million years. But once you get past 100,000, you're not talking hundreds of millions of years ago. You're talking about our recent past.
Relatively recent.
Relatively recent past.
Sure.
So a
sure.
few hundred thousand years ago, 100,000 years ago plus... was when you got the nuclear detonation.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like up to a few million years ago is when the planet detonated. Now, for some of your skeptical elements in the audience may be saying, you know, planets can't explode. That's so stupid, Courtney. Well, actually, that idea of rejecting thing is really, that's the problems that people actually have.
Mm-hmm.
They reject ideas because they don't have an automatic reason for it. But
sure.
planets are really easy to explode. They're not hard to explode.
Sure.
For example, sure. think of us, our planet, Earth. This is a piece of cake to explode. What you need is a very size, they have these so-called doomsday nuclear weapons. So all you need is a bunker that contains like 300 of them. And, you know, 300 nuclear weapons in one spot is not unthinkable. We already have that. We have each, in fact, just the United States alone has tens
sure.
of thousands
sure.
of nuclear
sure.
weapons. Well, where do you think those things are stored?
Well, it's kind of like forgive me for saying this, it's like the movie Dr. Strangelove back in the early
yeah.
60s, you know, the Doomsday Peter
yeah.
Sellers.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, if you
yeah.
have a whole bunch of nuclear weapons, some of which may be more powerful than the ones we have currently, but
right.
I don't know, say a few hundred in one spot.
Right.
And then you have another enemy wanting, like the Scandia Labs out in the Southwest. That's got hundreds of nuclear weapons buried in the ground.
Yeah.
So what happens yeah. if you then have an enemy that wants to take them out?
Right.
And sends in a bunker busting, and you're talking bunker busting, not just a bunker, but something that can penetrate like a mile deep. And there are ways you can do that. You can set, it can be a multiple detonation device. It, you know, detonates one thing after the next, basically getting into, but until you eventually get to the cavern and you detonate the few hundred nuclear weapons, thinking you're destroying them, but in fact they detonate. That would pop a huge hole in the planet. I remember, we only have a crust that's a few miles thick.
That's true.
After that, you've got a hole in the planet that's miles wide, and you're going to get an eruption that'll be visible throughout the whole solar system. So you can crack a planet if you have enough nuclear weapons. And apparently, you know, we're talking about a civilization that had that might have had weapons,
or
nuclear weapons,
maybe,
more powerful than the ones we have. And
maybe
those aren't, I mean, we could build nuclear weapons
right.
As powerful as the ones we're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of whether people are going to do it or not. So,
well,
but if you build a sufficient set of large nuclear weapons and detonate them, yeah, that planet can pop.
Well,
it's not so, just because Earth
yeah.
hasn't hasn't blown up doesn't mean it can't. And remind you, astronomers will say, no, only stars blow up, supernovas. Well, that's stupid.
Yeah.
They have never seen anything blow up.
Right.
All they see is a light in the sky, and I hypothesize that it was a star. Now, I'm sure that there are a lot of them that are stars. That's for sure. I mean, there's no question about that.
Sure.
But they can't say that every single thing that they've ever seen that's lit up in the sky is a star. They never sent a space probe out there to look at it, to see what actually blew up.
Well,
something out there blew up.
Courtney, real quick, I just wanted to make this quick comment that, I want to make a station break, too, that this is, for those who are just tuning in, this is Out of This World Radio with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of Bellevue, Washington, just outside Seattle in the United States. We have a fascinating gentleman on today named Courtney Brown of the Farsight Institute. We're talking about Atlantis, Mars, and remote viewing. And one thing I wanted to say, too, is it another possibility that they could have been attacked as well, Courtney?
Well, actually, that's a pet theory. You see, if they have, you mean Mars?
Yeah, Mars, 100,000 years ago with the nuclear fission.
No, it doesn't. Oh, you mean no, because whatever happened with the exploding planet that caused all the craters on that one side of Mars, that clearly happened a lot earlier. Than the nuclear explosion. They have a good dating on the nuclear explosion. For those people who want to sort of see the data and hear a good discussion, there's a brand new book. Actually, he has a few books out on it, but a couple books out on it. But there's a brand new one that just came out like a month or so ago by John Brandenburg called Death on Mars. Hmm. And he's a physicist. He used to work at the Scandia Labs, and I think also Lawrence Livermore.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a very, very solid mainstream type of guy that worked in the Defense Department and had access to he worked in Scandia Labs, mm-hmm. which is like the big one in mm-hmm. terms of nuclear weapons. And he had access to the Mars data, and he actually wrote a book about it, Death on Mars, and you can go to Amazon and sort of see it. So don't take my word for anything. I like your analogy of Missouri, the show-me state. With remote viewing, the good thing about it is I never ask people to believe me on anything. Mm-hmm. I just say, these are the data we got. This is what it says. You look at it for yourself. Understand how we collected it and the whole thing. Don't be from Missouri. Be like, show me. Like, yeah,
absolutely.
We can show you.
Absolutely.
We can
absolutely.
Show you now. So you only the issue that is really up there is whether you're going to take the time to look at it.
Well, there's one favor I'd like to ask you, and you can tell me the answer off air, but I'd love to know if you could remote view the winning lottery numbers for the next couple of weeks, and just give me a call on the site.
Actually, that's a very interesting question, but the lottery is actually a very tough. Every problem has its own unique solution, and the lottery numbers is actually a very difficult problem because of the We did yet another study on the existence of multiple timelines. We designed a study to test for the existence of multiple timelines, and the results were enormously confirmatory, in the sense that there are multiple timelines. That means that every moment of the now. By the way, this does correspond with the other world's interpretation of the quantum mechanical experiment with regard to Hugh Everett. Mm-hmm. Every moment of the now has a branching. Mm-hmm. There is multiple timelines, you know, going off in every direction.
Sure.
So there is no single one lottery number. Let's say I want to know tomorrow's lottery win.
Okay.
Well, Ted, which timeline are you talking about? Every possible number combination wins.
Mm-hmm.
And so which one are you going to be looking at? That's the problem with the lottery number.
I see.
That is it in a nutshell.
Okay.
And so, by the way, for those skeptical readers that say, oh, gosh, look at this, multiple timelines. how crazy can you get?
Right.
Well, the reality is that physicists have never, ever found anything solid anywhere. They've never, you can say, what are you talking about, Courtney? I have a car. How do you think I got to work today? I have a computer. I'm listening to a radio. But if you look into that stuff, it's just empty space and molecules.
Right.
And inside the molecules, they have empty space and atoms. And inside the atoms, it's empty space and protons, neutrons, electrons. And inside those things, and it goes on and on down the rabbit hole.
Right.
They have never, ever found anywhere a solid billiard ball type anything. Period. End of story. In fact, the physicists who are still looking for a solid particle, a solid thing, are called particleists, and they are becoming an extinct species. They almost don't exist anymore.
Oh, fascinating.
So the only thing that they have ever found, ever, are frequencies, waves, and E equals MC squared. Einstein is right. Right. Energy equals mass times the speed of light.
Right.
Energy and mass are the same. They equal each other. The point is, what we have in terms of our physical reality is the illusion of something solid. What you can say is that the only thing that they've ever discovered is frequencies that interact. And when the frequencies interact, they interact and create patterns. And these patterns are what we see. And the only way you have to get these patterns into the reality that we have now is by selecting out the frequencies that you combine, and thus our brains are extremely advanced hologram generators. Mm. They select out the frequencies they want you to see, and they screen out everything else, which is why remote viewing requires specialized training.
Sure.
Because you're nudging the machine. It's like saying you have an AM radio.
Right.
And you say you're tuned into one frequency, but you know there are other stuff out there. Well, you got to jimmy the radio a little bit in order to get something else out, because you're only locked into one frequency. So what remote viewers do is they train in order to let the brain lighten up.
Sure.
To allow in a coordinated manner stuff on other frequencies so that they can write it down in the frequency that we're sort of existing in. So that's the basic bottom line of the lottery number. There is a way to remote view lottery numbers, but we don't know whose lottery number that's going to be.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. I hope you don't mind me bringing up this subject, and I know we haven't had a lot of preparation time for it, but you're such an interesting fellow, Courtney. You've got all these things you've been researching for all these years, and I have to ask you a little bit about 9/11, if it's okay.
Sure.
There was a trailer that I watched on your website where it showed a gentleman drawing a boardroom of people discussing the 9/11 attack before it happened. They were actually planning it. Could you share some of that information? If you need some preparation, we can go on to certainly other subjects, but I wanted to ask you about that from your memory.
No, it's fine. No, the remote viewing, from the perspective of the remote viewing data,
right?
9/11 was entirely an inside job.
Okay.
The purpose of it was, and this is not unusual at all. You can say, how could they do such a thing? That's how they start all wars.
Okay.
That's how Bismarck started a war with France in order to create, his goal was to create a unified Germany out of all of these principalities.
Sure.
So he took a telegram known as the Elm Telegram, which was a very nice, benign telegram mm-hmm. that the King of Prussia was sending to Napoleon. Now, that's not Napoleon Bonaparte, but his cousin, his nephew, actually, who was, you know, related but distant, mm-hmm. you know, after mm-hmm. Napoleon Bonaparte. And mm-hmm. so this Napoleon got this telegram after it was intercepted by Bismarck. And Bismarck rewrote it, so he was basically giving him the bird. He was,
you know, oh, really?
He wrote a really obnoxious telegram and sent it off. And so rather than having the original Prussian telegram saying, don't worry, this is fine, everything's going to be okay, he got one saying, blankety blank you. And Napoleon blew a cork, and he uh-huh. invaded. And now that's exactly what Bismarck wanted. He wanted the invasion so that all the German principalities would feel aggrieved. We didn't do anything. What are you talking about? You're invading. For what purpose are you talking about? They didn't know anything about the Elm Telegram.
Interesting.
And so they all grouped together, and they had a Congress formed, and they unified as one nation and Bismarck, and that's how we got Germany. That's what Germany is today.
Interesting.
So, you know, the Vietnam War, we had the Gulf of Tonkin resolution because
sure.
of the incident in Tonkin.
Completely fake.
It was partly fake. The first incident was there was a couple torpedo boats that fired at the USS Maddox, the US destroyer, mm-hmm. causing essentially no damage whatsoever, like a mosquito bite. But they were too far away, and the Maddox fired back, and nothing. There was no damage.
Mm-hmm.
But the US people didn't want to, and the USS Maddox was in Vietnamese waters, so they sort of had a reason for going after them.
Right.
And they were also supporting, you know, military efforts against the North Vietnamese. So the North Vietnamese were sort of understandably ticked off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big deal was made in the United States about the Gulf of, you know, about this attack, this violent attack on the USS Maddox. And it was not reported that no damage occurred, but just that they were attacked. And then 2 days later, it was reported that the North Vietnamese did it again. They attacked the USS Maddox again. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, outraged, President Johnson went to Congress and said, we must have the ability to defend ourselves. And they passed a Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which allowed the United States, the U.S. president, to defend American troops anywhere. when in fact the second incident never occurred at all. I mean, it wasn't even a fake. It wasn't even like a little thing like fishing boats. It didn't happen. There was nothing that happened. So the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was based on fiction. And by the way, this is not in dispute historically. What is in dispute historically is whether Johnson knew consciously that he was lying to Congress. That's what's not known. But the fact that the second incident didn't happen whatsoever and the first incident was almost a non-event, that's not an historical dispute. So anyway, but then you look at and that started the Vietnam War.
Right.
And then if you look over history, it's very common for people. Look, for example, let me give you one more example. World War II.
Oh, FDR and his knowledge of the attack on Pearl Harbor before it happened?
Well, basically what happened, and this part of it is not in dispute, the FDR was being begged on a battleship in the North Atlantic by Churchill, where they were meeting,
right,
to enter World War II, because Churchill was basically saying, Franklin, let me tell you, they got these little things called buzz bombs. They're like landing on us. And like, there's like planes. They're like bombing us. They're attacking us. And it's like serious, Roosevelt. It's serious. You got to enter it now. And Roosevelt said, no, I'm not going to enter the war no matter what. Like Woodrow Wilson entered World War I with a divided nation.
Right.
There was a lot of isolationist elements in the United States. So he would have been fighting the war in Europe as well as domestic squabbles. He had to wipe out the domestic squabbles. You had people like Joseph Kennedy, who was the father of Robert, Ted, and John Kennedy.
Right.
And he was notoriously anti-British, right, also anti-Semitic. He had all types of crazy things. But yeah, he was absolutely isolationist, mm-hmm, and did not want... He was rabid about not wanting to help out the British in their war.
Sure.
And Roosevelt would have had to deal with him afterwards. And so Roosevelt told Churchill that he was not going to enter the war until there was an incident in the Pacific, and that was going to happen soon, and that he was going to wait for that incident, and that would wipe out domestic opposition, and then he would be allowed to send troops in a full engagement in the European thing. He knew that the Japanese were going to do something, mm-hmm, but that wasn't the big war. Mm-hmm. But we had to wait for that in order to enter the thing that really needed to happen, which was the defeat, mm-hmm, of the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I can say this is not in dispute, for those of your listeners who may be rolling their eyes, mm-hmm, go to YouTube and search on for some videos hosted by Henry Fonda, called Roosevelt Manipulator in Chief and Roosevelt Hail to the Chief. Those two, Hail to the Chief, I think, is the one that has it the most. Anyway, there you'll see Turner Catledge, who was the editor in chief of the New York Times, who was a close associate of Roosevelt, tell the whole story, meaning he personally. Roosevelt personally told him all of this stuff. And this is the editor-in-chief of the New York Times discussing the entire thing, said, no, this is what had to happen. We had to wait. Roosevelt had to do this. This is Roosevelt's confidant. I mean, this is not like an unreliable person. This is the editor-in-chief of the New York Times. So, you know, the only thing that's not, so all of that I told you is not in dispute. The only thing that is in dispute is whether Roosevelt knew specifically about the exact attack on that exact day of Pearl Harbor.
There was a conversation that a Nazi submarine U-boat intercepted in the North Atlantic. It was very interesting. I think it happened in either September or October of 1941, where he was talking with Winston Churchill in London, and it was recorded by the Nazis, and the Allies found it in Germany after the war, where Churchill had said something that they had actually a spy among the cabinet of Hitler's cabinet, and they had been told about the Pearl Harbor attack. And all that FDR said was that that would be a dastardly thing to do, and didn't say anything else. So,
yeah, there's the only thing that's sort of supportive of the idea that maybe Roosevelt did know anything specific about it is that we had two destroyers that were our newest, fastest, best destroyers in Hawaii, and they were mysteriously removed from Pearl Harbor 2 days before the attack.
Sure.
And those two destroyers were used for 3 months extensively in the Pacific to confuse the Japanese, meaning what they would do is they'd go and be sighted, they'd go under high speed and be sighted by the Japanese fleet in one area. They would not engage. They'd quickly turn around and zip over to another area of the Pacific and be sighted again. Hmm. So what would happen is that the Japanese were saying, I thought we got rid of all those boats, but they're all over the place. We're sighting them here and there and every place. Hmm. And that put the Japanese into a state of confusion. Mm-hmm. And for those 3 months, they were able to rebuild the Pacific fleet.
Oh, well. Hmm.
Yeah, so that was a very clever strategy. Now, but again, it's in dispute, and I do not know whether Roosevelt knew anything about the specifics of the exact attack. But those are that's sort of the anecdotal evidence that there might have been something. But there is it's absolutely not in dispute that he knew there was going to be a major incident in the Pacific, and he was counting on it,
right,
waiting for it. And when it happened, as soon as it happened, he got everything he wanted. He entered the European arena, that declared war on Japan, but the next day, you know, war on Germany, and the whole thing started. It was the Germans that was his real focus. Japan was a relatively minor skirmish relative to what had to happen in Germany.
Right.
By the way, there's one more sort of scientific way of thinking about all of this. In science, all of science is built on statistics. Everything in science is built on statistics in some way or means. And the only thing that you can do to predict something is to say, do I have any other information that would give me leverage to knowing how I can predict something? In the absence of other information, the only prediction that you can make is the mean, the average.
Right.
So, for example, before 1995, virtually all mainstream astronomers, with almost no exceptions, were arguing ferociously that there were no other major planets around any other star in the universe, not just a galaxy, in the universe, because the criteria for forming planets was so extreme it just wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. We are unique. Then in 1995, they found their first planet around another system, and that started. Now we get, you know, planets every week. We're finding them all over the place.
Sure, right.
But a lot of people don't remember back to the ferociousness at which the astronomers are arguing it can't happen. But now look, they had a sample of one, where we had our own solar system. We had 9 major planets, asteroids, meteors, comets, junk galore, all over the place.
Yeah.
The only thing they could have said scientifically is, well, we have one sample, a sample of one, and it's got 9 planets. So on average, there's probably 9 planets around every star. So, that's the only thing scientifically, but there was nothing to support the idea of 0 planets around any star in the whole universe.
Sure.
So what they were clearly doing is arguing theology, yet they were ferociously saying they were scientists, but they were arguing belief systems. They wanted to say they were unique. So why am I mentioning this now? Because when we brought up World War II, look at what Hitler did, the Holocaust. And when you think about the Holocaust, you think about 6 million Jews that were killed.
Right.
But you have to remember there were 20 million Slavs also. So you're talking nearly 30 million people. Right. So, you know, a lot of people think of the Holocaust as being a Jewish thing. It was much bigger than that. Right. It was a Jewish thing, but it was also Gypsies and Slavs, mega numbers. Now, let's consider that one of the worst case, or maybe the worst case things that's happened on our planet, the Holocaust, okay?
Okay.
Well, then you can say, well, you know, what about other planets? Now that we know that there are other planets. Well, what about other civilizations? Well, now that we know they have a sample of one of our civilization, we must assume that there's lots of planets out there with other civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what if we did a survey of worst case situations?
Mm-hmm.
The only prediction we can say is, well, we only have a sample of one, the Holocaust.
Hmm.
We can only say, absent any other information, we can only say that's the mean. That means that there must have been situations that were way worse than the Holocaust.
Yeah.
As bad as the Holocaust was, and I'm not minimizing anything, yeah, I'm just saying from a scientific perspective, a larger galaxy, there must have been situations that were far, far worse than the Holocaust. And I'm not minimizing or or anything with regard to the Holocaust.
Sure.
This whole idea that you know something that's really bad could have been worse elsewhere.
Right.
That is unsupportable. So if you think about really why we exist as a planet, why we exist as a species on a planet that really should not have a human civilization on it, right, you might come to the conclusion, and this is speculative on my part, that we might be people who fled a situation that was really, really, really worse anything that we could ever imagine that's happened yet on Earth. It's just a speculation, possible
from Mars or elsewhere. We've got just a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind, back to 9/11 again. So I'd be just curious if you could share the remote viewing that was done there.
Well, it was from the remote viewing data, it was clearly an inside job, and the purpose was to push us into a war so we could control the oil fields. But it was extremely well planned out, and the videos that we have of it, all with the remote viewing done live on video, captured under totally blind conditions, describe it in a level of detail that literally brings you into a cold sweat. I mean, it's the level of detail of the exact specificity of all of the known things as well as the other stuff. I mean, for example, the thing that hit the Pentagon.
Right.
It wasn't a jet. There's a lot of pilots, thousands, that have signed on petitions, have their own organizations that say, look, we fly those things for a living. You can't do that. That thing flew at treetop level till it got right over the Pentagon grounds. And then immediately after getting over the treetops of the backyard of the Pentagon, it dove down and then leveled off immediately 4 feet over the top of the ground and flew level and smacked into the... flew over the background of the backyard of the Pentagon and flew right into the wall of the Pentagon. You can't do that with a jumbo jet. I don't care if you're Tom Cruise and Top Gun. A jumbo jet can't do that. And also the hole in the Pentagon is the wrong size. And whatever did hit the Pentagon had no wings. There's no wings in the wreckage. So, and most jumbo jets, to my understanding, have wings. the thing didn't have any wings.
Well, this brings other questions, too. I know we don't have a lot of time left, Courtney, but then was it a cruise missile? And what happened to the
It was a cruise missile launched from a submarine, and we have it all explicitly told out. It was a cruise missile launched from a submarine. Wow. Cruise missiles can, in fact, do that.
Wow.
We even have the name of the cruise missile, the type of missile it actually is. So, and it was launched from a submarine, and and in terms of the New York stuff, Building 7 is the real key thing, because Building 7 is the building that most people don't focus on. They think of the Twin Towers, but there's actually three buildings that collapsed.
Right.
Building 7 was the original World Trade Center, and that was the one that housed, really a strong building. It houses the emergency bunker for the mayor in case anything should happen.
Right.
It was a really well constructed building,
and that completely collapsed, disintegrated.
Yeah,
that
was actually demolished. It was not acknowledged to being demolished, but for the video of it falling down is clearly a demolition. And there are thousands of architects that have signed on. This group called Architects and Engineers. They have, enormous numbers of architects that have said, these are really big guys. That was a controlled demolition. Yeah, you can't be a building. Besides, in the history of all modern architecture, never in the history has an office furniture fire, which is what the officials say, ever brought down a building. I mean, at worst, you can burn it out and it's a shell, but it's still there.
Sure.
And this thing was a complete instant collapse.
I'm sorry to say this, my friend, but we've got just about a minute left, and I wanted to say thank you. I'm going to give you the last couple of seconds here, but I want to
If I could just encourage people to go to our website, farsight.org, www.farsig, S-I-G-H-T, like seeingfar.org, and if first thing you do before you do anything else, sign up for our free newsletter. We are a nonprofit. We have no advertising. We can't tell people what we do unless you sign up for the newsletter. We don't give the email addresses out to anybody for anything whatsoever. And the email and the newsletter goes out once a week. So
okay,
if you do Courtney, nothing else, sign up for the newsletter.
Next week, in the next couple of weeks, we'll have Governor Jesse Ventura, Scott Limriel, William Arntz, a famous Hollywood film producer, and some more interesting people on. And thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.